Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor is the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow in Military History and Classics at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marcia Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. He writes for American Greatness, and we do these tantalizing episodes for the podcast world. And we are part of John Solomon's Just the News organization. And so he is the flagship for our podcast. So we welcome everybody. Today, this episode, we're going to start with Biden and a little bit more on both Biden files and Biden's presidency. But first, let's take a moment for these messages. We'll be right back.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back to the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, I often ask you how you are today. I want you to note that I am in a house that does not have heat, and so I'm very, very, very cold, and I am in the middle of California, and we have unusually cold temperatures here. I just want you to know that.
That's because we are sitting on the Monterey Shelf, which is one of the richest natural gas deposits in the United States, and we won't tap it. So we're importing, I suppose, natural gas or propane, whatever it is, that's in short supply, and it's very expensive. California, especially right now.
So pretty crazy.
That's the story of the state. You didn't even ask, you didn't wait till I told you that I felt well.
Oh,
you asked
sorry.
Me how I and was.
Yeah, you.
I drove this
I
morning.
I hear
from,
you're doing well. Yeah.
I drove this morning from my graduate alma mater at Stanford at 4:30 in the morning. And I left behind the Stanford euphemism list, where you cannot say citizen or American. I left behind the Bankman-Fried faculty home with Mr. Sam himself there with the paparazzi lurking around. I left the president under a controversy about a supposedly improper use of an illustration in one of his co-authored articles, and they're out to dismiss him. And I went from Matt Walsh is going to visit, and the Stanford Student Council is going to pay for demonstrators or protesters. That's kind of like a rent a demonstrator against him. And I walked across campus and got a full dose of being woke. And then I'm back in reality in the San Joaquin Valley of California, where people are normal.
You sound like you're just coming out of the theater of the absurd.
Or waking up in a Kafka novel when I go there. Yeah, it's you know, I'm not critical of it in this sense that I grew up with stories of my poor grandfather. He never went to college, of course, and he didn't have a lot of money. He had a little 120-acre farm, and he mortgaged it to send his three daughters to college. So when I grew up, my mother and aunt had BAs and graduate, one law, one an MA, and they thought Stanford was a pillar of opportunity. And my cousin went there, I went there, and it always had that propensity for extremes because it had this strange marriage or weld or fusion between being very, very wealthy and kind of left wing. That's a bad combination. So I was reminded of that when I was walking across campus yesterday to my apartment, and I counted the number in the dorm, beautiful homes that serve as dorms. And I counted in three blocks, two Lexuses, two Mercedes, and three BMWs by the Wolksters. And that's all you need to know, to paraphrase John Keats. Yeah. Or is that, Ode to a Grecian Urn.
Yeah. All right. So, Victor, what is the latest? I know we've had so much on Biden and his files found in all sorts of places. Seems to me there was a new trove just recently to come out, but I was wondering what your thoughts are on the recent events.
Yeah, that's interesting because they used a new word. I'm a philologist, so I always try to pay attention to vocabulary. They use the word item. You know what I mean? Is my Dodge truck an item? Is the South 20 out here, is that an item? Or is it one almond tree? Or is it 6,000 of them? The point is, when they don't say they found so many classified files or papers, but they say items, are those trunks? Nobody knows. So they're playing word games. And, you know, I think they've exhausted the Trump was worse argument, as we talked a little bit about last time. Trump had one place, remember, and he had it for 19 months. This is now going back to Biden as a senator. A senator.
I know.
You know, not, he hasn't been senator since 2008. And so you're getting up there to 15, 16 years they've been floating around. And, you know, if you look at matters of time and space, the time is much more than Trump's 19 months. He had it at Mar-a-Lago. Only a drunken sailor would say that Mar-a-Lago is less secure than Biden's garage. It's a joke. And then, you know, we mentioned that Biden keeps commenting on the ongoing investigation. You like when Karine Jean-Pierre says we can't comment on an ongoing investigation? I thought, yes, you can, because Joe Biden does it all the time. He characterizes the investigation of him as there is no there. And he characterizes the investigation of Trump as utterly irresponsible, as if he's tried, convicted, and found guilty. So he does all the time. And there's the asymmetry. I just wish they would take that locker in the garage and dump it and spread all of the papers all over the garage. And then the FBI could do what they did in the Trump matter and photograph it. And then it would appear in the Drudge Report or something, or the Bulwark, with, oh my gosh, scattered Biden papers found all over the garage floor. Or better yet, if they didn't do that, they could at least have those guys with the black SUV and kind of the bulked up body armor with the automatic weapons outside Mar-a-Lago, outside the garage. Something to at least give some shred of symmetry.
Yeah.
But rather than Merrick Garland say, we don't treat Democrats any different than Republicans, Rich. But yes, you do. That's what you were there for. You were there to play an Eric Holder wingman. That's what your job is. Don't insult our intelligence. But there's so many discrepancies. I will say, to finish this rant, Sammy, there is one red line. Everybody listening knows what it is. It's a huge dinosaur, elephant, whale in the room. It's a mixed metaphors. We all know what it is. Hunter Biden was in the Biden residence where there were unsecured classified documents that had been moved around. Hunter Biden had access to a garage by which, with photographs of which, we can see how sloppily stored our, the public's, classified documents were. If it turns out that the FBI takes fingerprints, right, of all the documents that are classified, and if one fingerprint turns out to be Hunter Biden's under any circumstances, just one, or if Miranda Devine and others who go through the laptop contents find any reference by Hunter Biden that he has knowledge of some development or somebody that can be traced to those classes, then Joe Biden's done. He will be impeached and he will even be convicted and he will be out of office. That is a red line. And that's the subtext of this whole apprehension on their part. They do not want to talk about it. They don't want to give details. They don't want to tell you how they got there. I guess they grew legs and walked. Because there was no human agent that delivered these documents other than Joe Biden. I guess. I don't know who. I don't think Tara Reid took the documents out when he was a senator as an aide. He drove her off. I don't know who did. You know what I'm saying? So how did they get out of his Senate office? How did they get out of the vice president? Who moved them from one place to the other? Where were they before they were lodged in the University of Pennsylvania think tank building? They don't want to talk about any of this. And I think part of the problem is they know where it leads. I really do think that Hunter Biden, either he was conveyed information by his father, and that's one of the reasons his father kept consulting these classified intelligence report, or he had access himself. But we'll find out, I hope.
Yeah, we sure will. Which brings me to an article I was looking at where I couldn't resist, because it said, Is Biden a viable candidate for 2024? I know, it was so funny. I had
that's
to
a word,
because
viable, you know, is
I just want to tell you where it came from, though, because it came out of The Guardian, which you said at once was a socialist newspaper, by a guy named Robert Reich.
That's Clinton's labor secretary. You mean a socialist, neo-communist, hardcore zealot, Robert Reich.
Yes. And I opened it because I thought this guy's going to say yes. And of course he did say yes, but he said, for these reasons, right? Has he done a good job so far? Yes. Should he run again? Most certainly. And would we find somebody to run if he doesn't? And all he could say to that was, we didn't know Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton 2 years before they were elected president. And he said,
what does that
mean
that we should never elect anybody like them? One who was impeached and lied to while he was under oath, and the other person was totally incompetent?
Exactly. Well, he said Joe Biden's age might be a bit of a concern, and to the question of whether he thought he could beat Trump, were Trump the Republican candidate, he said, well, he's done it once. That's all he had to answer to that. So it was really a bad yes that he said yes.
Yeah, I mean, you use the word viable. I meant, you know, it's weary in Latin. It means you have to be alive. He's not completely alive, so he's not viable health-wise or cognitively. I suppose they're looking. You know what I cannot grasp is they have these little Phillips where they talk about the papers and they say things like this. The mainstream, whatever we call it, media, they say, until this, Biden was coming off a string of successes, or there was a substantial record of achievement. What was that? The border? He destroyed it. It doesn't exist. There were 5 to 6 million entries. He's destroyed the U.S. border towns. 100,000 people died of fentanyl poisoning in the United States. The vast majority sent from China, raw product, and assembled or manufactured in cartel factories for the sole purpose of killing us. That's what he did.
Can I tell you inflation? Oh, yeah.
He says 6.5 is great. Is it gas prices? They're up 20 cents a gallon again. I just filled up last week. It was $5.15 for diesel fuel. It's on its way back up to $6.50. What has he done? He just borrowed another $1.5 trillion. That's success. We're going to pay $450 billion on the national debt this year in interest alone. The housing market has collapsed. What is the achievement? Would somebody tell me what was so good that gave him his momentum up to 43% approval? I don't understand it. It's like these people live in an alternate universe. Okay, you tell me what Mr. Reich says was an accomplishment or achievement, and then pause for one nanosecond and I will comment.
Okay. All right. So he says that the economy was well done.
Okay, stop. What was well done? We're having massive layoffs right now. We have sky-high interest rates compared to the last 40 years. We've had two quarters of negative growth. We're going to have we had one where we didn't, but we will have a negative one coming up. And we have record high fuel prices. What? Okay, go ahead. So that was the economy.
The infrastructure is next.
What did we do? We have infrastructure, I suppose, in California, but we just let out 12 million acre feet of water because we were told there's nowhere to store it because we never built any infrastructure. Where is the infrastructure? It's not going to be infrastructure. It's not going to be roads and bridges. You think Pete Buttigieg is going to do that? No. It's going to be in race and gender and diversity, equity, inclusion, entitlements, you know, earmarks. I mean, look at Pete. If you give Pete a bunch of money, what's he going to do with the Port of L.A.? Or the train robbing in L.A.? Or Southwest Airlines, or the computerized, Federal Aviation Administration. It's all a mess. So go ahead.
Okay. In fact, what you just said was his accomplishment, too. He got all of the left-wing things he wanted to pass passed in the first 2 years because the Congress was on his side. But let me tell you his exception. So he failed.
He didn't get all of them. He got the Inflation Reduction Act. We didn't get Build Back Better. They did stop that.
I liked his exceptions, Victor, and they were the only things he's done badly are Afghanistan and a few documents in his house.
The only thing he's done badly are Afghanistan, in which he abandoned over two decades worth of blood and treasure. He gave up a $300 million remodeled largest Air Force base in Central Asia. He abandoned a $1 billion embassy. He abandoned somewhere between $40 and $60 billion. And by the way, we're very short of equipment now, thanks to the Ukraine war, but he abandoned that and turn Kabul into an international arms mart for terrorists. And he destroyed U.S. deterrence, which I think Vladimir Putin understood very well, because right after we did that in August, he began to mobilize and we was massing troops by the end of the year on the borders of Ukraine. That's what he did. That was the biggest disaster in foreign policy since the 1975 skedaddle from Vietnam. And then there was the documents where he lied repeatedly and he said that he's always been very serious about it. He's never been very serious. We now know that he wasn't serious as a senator. He was not serious as a vice president. He was not serious as a private citizen, and he was not serious as the president. He was just the opposite. He was unserious. He's given a great gift. He's true. One of his great accomplishments is he is forging a mechanism for the backroom Democrats to have a way to get rid of him. And that's why when you look at those press conferences just now, just a little bit, they're starting to have some semblance, some of a press conference. These people actually came out of their zombie-like states and are asking real questions, maybe 20% of them. He did do that. And the only reason that they're doing that is there's a sizable number that see him as toxic and they think he will destroy the Democratic Senate, and he will, and he will not win and he won't, and they want to get rid of him. And this is a way to get rid of him.
probably is true. Well, let's go ahead then and turn to the war in Ukraine. And recently we've been hearing about arguments or resistance on the part of the Germans, for example, to send Leopard 2 tanks in and saying they won't do it until the U.S. sends its Abrams tank in. We've seen lots of arms given to the Ukrainians and other things like Stryker armed personnel carriers and Bradley fighting vehicles. And then we, of course, have all of the senators, I think, that are senators and representatives that are calling out, like Josh Hawley calling out the billions being given of taxpayer money to this war. J.D. Vance asking for an audit of the $100 billion that's already been in. So we've got a lot of concern about the money and the materiel that's going all to this war. And I was wondering.
Well, it's very ironic because the left under Obama cut in real dollars the defense budget and Trump tried to increase it. And Biden has ossified it again. Keep that in mind, because at the same time they did that, they went full hog into Ukraine, and that it's over $100 billion now. So the result of that is on this is the first conventional war we've really seen since Vietnam. And that wasn't quite a conventional war like this. There is no jungle here. It's a luce libre. It's just go to it. And it's consuming weapons at a fanatical. It's just fanatic what they're doing. It's crazy. And we don't have them, because we didn't invest in them. So you hear that these we've given them, a million shells, 155 millimeter shells, the mainstay of medium artillery. And we're now taking them out of Israel, 300,000. Why were they there? They were there for a reason. They were there in case there's a Middle East blow up and we can't get military support to Israel in time. Now we're depleting that entire trove for Ukraine. And there's been a series of studies this week out of think tanks in Washington that suggests that it'll take 5 to 6 years to rebuild the stash of javelins that we had before this war. And we're on every type of munitions and weapon systems. We are depleted. We were before. So what I'm getting at is, if China wants to watch and wait, and this goes on for another 6 months, and then it decides to go into Taiwan, we won't have the wherewithal to stop them, even if we wanted to. And so I don't quite get the idea that the left is just clamoring, give us those shells, give us those javelins, we need Bradleys, we need this. How dare you not get, and then they don't want to pay for them in peacetime for our use. It's almost as if like they've discovered there's a military budget, or there's such things as shells. Wow, we have tanks, give them to Ukraine. Or it's almost as if they don't want us to have them. We can be the arsenal for democracy just so we don't have them ourselves. But it's very reckless what they're doing. And yeah, no one's sure talking about it, because it's sort of Zelensky, end of conversation. Anytime you want to talk to anybody about it, Zelensky, end of conversation. As if he's Lincoln or somebody. And there's a lot of issues there that have been, it's sort of like the COVID, the left does this with these hot button issues. You couldn't, you know, for much of 2020, you couldn't question the wisdom or the efficacy, to use that word, the viability of the lockdowns and quarantines. To do that was ostracism. Look what happened to Scott Atlas. And the same thing as Ukraine, you can't question our strategy or policy or anything. And so, you know, that's an issue that the Europeans are looking at this and they're thinking, the United States has been giving $100 billion. They're going to probably end up having to give 300 or 400. At some point, they're going to end a recession. Their borders wide open. They have an election coming up in 2 years. I don't think they're going to continue to do this. And therefore, why would we want to be out by giving our top model Leopard tanks and only to have the Russians get angry at us and cut permanently off our natural gas? So they're not going to do anything unless we show that we're going to ship them, Abrams tanks?
Yeah.
And that's going to be very difficult. Those are gas turbine, I think, engines. They really gulp gas. I think they're much better than the Leopard. The Leopard is supposed to be the best tank in the world, but it's, you know, it's not. The latest model Abrams is much better in many ways. Yeah. I think they have the same German manufactured 150 millimeter gun, but other than that,
how much are they? That's my question.
They're $2 or $3 million each. More. That's what they originally cost. I bet they're up to $4 or $5 million. They have everything on them. I mean, the Americans are promiscuous in their use of, you know, depleted uranium armor and shell. They don't do that over in Europe. They don't have any of that. And it's to our advantage, at least on the battlefield it is. But he wants what? I think he wants F-16s. He wants Abrams tanks. Zelensky, you might as well just say, I want everything you have. Just give me everything you have. I want all your shells. I want all your drones. I want all your Patriots. I want everything. And, you know, South Korea is not telling us. You know what's going to happen with this? I'll tell you what's going to happen. We are going to be so indebted to Ukraine, and we're going to exhaust our depots, and it's going to go on and on. And meanwhile, if you look at what Iran is saying, and South Korea is saying, and what China is saying, Taiwan, they're all saying, we're afraid of the Chinese, we're afraid of the Iranians, we're afraid of the North Koreans. That's all our best allies, Australia, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan. And we're not able to, I don't think we're going to be able to protect them. And you know what's going to happen? If Iran goes nuclear, they're all going to go nuclear. They're going to just say, you know what? South Korea is already talking about it. They're just saying, you know what? I don't believe the United States in its current fiscal and material condition and its political turmoil is committed to putting us under the nuclear umbrella. And when they exhaust their conventional forces and their ability to help us in extremists, they're not going to come. And so we're not going to sit here with a sword of Damocles over our head if you're in Seoul or Tokyo. So they will go nuclear. And that's, I don't think the Biden people understood that the reason that these countries did not go nuclear is the United States had such overwhelming economic and military strength and such superior weaponry and such stocks and inventories of lethal weapons that they thought they were in a great position. And we were so ready to assist them in their hour of need. I don't think any of that exists anymore. It's for Ukraine, maybe. But just, we have enemies that don't like us and they don't like our allies, and they could very easily simultaneously stir up trouble along the DMZ or in the South China Sea, and we wouldn't be able to respond, or in Israel. So somebody said, I heard someone speaking, well, these are just 300,000 shells that are in Israel. Why were they there then if they're not important? They were there for a reason. And it's weird. I understand it's tragic what's happening in Ukraine. They're killing innocent people. Putin's a thug. The Russians are in the wrong. But this idea that this is the moment of our entire lives, this former Russia, part of the Russian Federation, or I should say the Soviet Union, with historic ties to Russia, there had to be some type of negotiations that would have preserved the autonomy of Ukraine without provoking Russia. In other words, Russia could look at this country and say it's got enormous potential. If it modernizes, it will help us, but it will not be part of the EU or NATO. But that wasn't to be.
Yeah. Well, Victor, let's go ahead and take a break and then come back and talk a little bit about professors quitting the university because of woke. We'll be right back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car.
That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
We're back. I would like to remind everybody that Victor can be found on his website at victorhansen.com. The name of the website is The Blade of Perseus, and you can join for a $5 a month subscription, or you can get a $50 a month subscription. So please come join us at The Blade of Perseus. Also, there is a, for people in the Fresno area, there is a talk on February 6th at the Clovis Community College by Daniel D. Martino. He is a Venezuelan who is getting a PhD at Columbia University, and he'll be talking on socialism as he experienced it in Venezuela, and it's put on by the Young Americans for Freedom chapter at the Clovis Community College, and it's worth supporting these young students. They do have as well a case against the administration for stopping their free speech, which of course the National Young Americans for Freedom Foundation is aiding them with, but also FIRE, Victor. And I heard that you are on the board of FIRE. You were talking on another show, or you're somehow attached with the FIRE.
I like FIRE. I support FIRE, but FIRE, among the American Freedom Alliance, have both been very critical of Governor DeSantis because he has decided to go after the mandatory indoctrination. The black, it was called Black Queer Theory, in these K through 12 grades, mm-hmm. where students are being indoctrinated, and FIRE and the AFA have decided this is a free speech issue, and to show that they're not conservative or liberal, they have come down against the governor.
Oh, wow.
But what I'm arguing is, I was arguing on another show, that that is not free speech, a violation to say, you know, you can't go into the schools and get a captive audience and indoctrinate people and say, you know, this is the black queer experience and this is going to be part of it. Just it's politically loaded.
Yeah.
Any more than you could go in there and say, you know, the whole history of the United States is the anti-abortion movement. That was very key to it. And we're going to drill that into you. America was founded on anti-abortion. You understand that? Or if you brought in something else, it would be very controversial. And that would be sort of the gasoline engine and carbon emissions made this country. That happens to be true. But if you just kept saying that and indoctrinating students for the contemporary political advantages of people on the right, they go crazy.
Yeah.
So I was very disappointed in those two organizations that sort of criticized the governor, because I think what he's doing is wonderful.
Yeah. Well, in addition, we have on Powerline another University of Alabama professor who is quitting, and his reasons are the push for, quote, equity in sciences has changed the profession. He says that, quote, the rise of illiberalism in the name of DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion, is the antithesis of the principles of the universe that the university was founded on. And he said something interesting, because he was a geology professor. He said that the false climate emergency, the false climate emergency narrative can't be addressed openly, and that his colleagues are seem, as he put it, afraid to say anything about it being false, but they will say to him privately that they think the climate emergency is a, there's problems with the whole science behind that, but they're
what he's saying is, he's kind of well known. I think his name was Wilicki or something. Wilicki, I've read something about him. And it's not quite true that his colleagues, because there is a climatologist there at University of, I think it's at Huntsville, if that's the campus, yeah. John Christie. And he's outspoken. And he's kind of made a name for the University of Alabama. And so is Wilicki. So it's kind of known. It's got the same brand that Stanford University does in immunology. In other words, everybody in the Stanford Medical School went after Scott Atlas almost and signed, and they went after Michael Levitt, and they went after Jay Bhattacharya, and they went after John Ioannidis, all because they endorsed the Swedish model, or they said that the vaccinations would not be permanently viable. They would be more like flu shots at best. And they are all proven right. But the point I'm making is, you would think that Stanford University would have capitalized on four brilliant immunologists, public health. They were all in different fields, immunology, public health, biology, et cetera. And they would have used that and said, look, Stanford is an arena of free speech. It's give and take and yang. We have everything here. The only thing that we demand is excellence. Instead, they didn't. They destroyed that asset. They really did. And they went after those four people, and they were proven right. Now they look stupid. But my point is that it's very important for a university to encourage excellence and not indoctrination. And you know what happens is, the more Stanford went after those four, the more their stature rose as the empirical data from the epidemic confirmed their prognoses. And I think what's going to happen is, you're going to get a Republican president in 2024, and they're going to look around and they're going to say, who are the top people in public health policy as it relates to epidemics and COVID and immunology that were right in this hour of need? Oh my God, they're John Ioannidis, they're Jay Bhattacharya, they're Scott Atlas, they're Michael Levitt, they're all from Stanford, and Stanford's a great university. So you know what? Let's see now. One of you will be CDC, one will be NIH, one will be FDA, one will be National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Disease. That's what I bet will happen, because they're the best known. Yeah. And yet they don't claim them. I don't understand that. And the same thing was about University of Alabama. They had a couple of people there who were at the forefront of the climate debate, and they weren't crazy. They were using empirical data going back to the 19th century, with a caveat that, say, in California, and John Christie was very good about that. He's, we don't have a lot of records. The state wasn't really keeping records till about 1855, 1860. And the planet is very old, and California is very young. So to postulate these massive climate change due to the emission of carbon after the Industrial Revolution started is very bogus. But they were never saying that the planet wasn't heating up. They were saying the following, that throughout the millennia, the planet goes through cycles where it has been colder than it is now, and it has been hotter. And these cycles can go on for hundreds of years. They can go on for 20 years. But they're not necessarily affected by carbon emissions. And to the degree that they are since the Industrial Revolution, it is not at all clear that those emissions have resulted in radical temperature hikes, maybe 1 degree Fahrenheit or 2 degrees Fahrenheit over 50 or 100 years. And it's not agreed on that you can stop it with viable means. That is, realistically, when you have China and India that are 40% of the world's population are the greatest polluters. And so that's what they were saying. But that's like saying to these people, that if you were a devout Christian, you would deny the divinity of Jesus Christ. So in their way of thinking, that's their Christ-like figure. And they would say, how dare you? That's blasphemy. And they've gone after them. And this professor decided, you know what? Life's too short. It's too short. That's what happens to people, by the way, when they leave academia. I retired from teaching at 49 as 21 years a professor. And then I went to an academic institution, but not as a professor. It's a research institute. But when you talk to people who do, everybody thinks you're crazy or they were crazy. But you talk to them, they feel like they're liberated, like they're normal again, because it's such a hothouse, abnormal existence in academia.
Of people who do stupid things, as you're saying. But you know what? You said, they're going to look stupid now, or they've done something stupid with Scott and Bhattacharya and Ioannidis. But I don't think it's stupid enough, because I don't think they're going to stop, or the stupid are going to just double down on more stupid.
They haven't apologized. They never apologized to any of them. The 95 or whatever it was, Stanford Medical School faculty who said that Scott was a public menace or a danger, or the people who went after Bhattacharya or Ioannidis. Mm-hmm. And I don't think so, but there is an irony there, isn't there? That their opposition to them and their shrillness and their attacks were welcomed by the left, and they gave it so much play, thinking they were going to destroy these men, that they became iconic. And then as the pandemic evolved, and as the virus mutated, and as the series of vaccinations and boosters didn't pan out as advertised, and as the once demonic Sweden started to be re-examined with no greater morbidity than many European countries, but with much greater economic dynamism and less social cultural damage, people started to change. These people, a lot of us agreed with these guys in the beginning, but nevertheless, my point is this, that they've been confirmed, they've been shown to be correct by the data, and their opponents have been discredited. And they're going to, if you're going to be a Republican administration and you're not just ideologically blind like the left is, then you're going to want people who have a proven record. And who's the most prominent? It's these people from Stanford. So, and the way that the left has set up this bureaucracy, and I'm not saying they did it alone, but they have control of $50-100 billion in grants, more. So wouldn't it be ironic that these guys would have control and would reorganize the whole medical bureaucracy into a much more fair, open, and transparent process, where they were adjudicating people by the merits and not whether they were loyal to Dr. Fauci or Collins or had ties with Echo Health or were working with Big Pharma, whatever they do. So I think it's going to boomerang. I really do. I think that one day in our lifetime, we're going to see one of those three or four as the head of the CDC or the NIH or the FDA, and they will, I think, be very different than who's there now. And the people who thought they were first and these people were last, these people will be first and they will be last. They thought they were the alpha. They're going to be the omega.
Yeah, I hope you're right. And I have a smaller story that some emails have been requested in a court case disclosure. And so they've been given over from the NIH, and they revealed that Fauci did have people telling him that this virus might have been engineered in a lab. And that didn't surprise me, probably not you, but what I thought was interesting, that Fauci was writing that he was worried about damaging science in general and in China in particular. And that was an interesting disclosure of those emails.
Fauci used the word science the way that people in government use the word national security or executive privilege. Whenever there's something embarrassing or damning or self-incriminating, some person in the White House of either party will say, we can't comment, that's a matter of national security. Or they'll, you know what I mean? They'll say, we have executive privilege. So whenever he's cornered, he just says the science shows it. I can't, you know, it's not me, it's the science. Or if he's in a moment of self-revelation, he says, I am the science, you know, the state is me. Yeah. He's Louis the 14th, he thinks. But the point I'm making is that they don't want the truth to come out. He should want all of the emails because he knows what he did. As soon as that virus was discovered and it was associated with that lab and it broke out and the Chinese were suppressing, a little light went off in Fauci's head. He said, oh my God, Collins and I, to evade U.S. prohibitions on the use of gain-of-function viral engineering, allowed money from us to go to our old buddy Peter Daszak at Echo Health. He rerouted it to that crazy bat lady at the Wuhan level 4. And I am afraid that this thing could be connected to what we did. And theoretically, we could be partial parents of this thing. And that would be the end of us. So we've got to suppress, and make fun and ridicule and demonize anybody who would dare follow that train of thought. And that's what they did.
Yeah. And it surprises me that he was worried about affecting science or impacting science badly when he's the one that actually did impact science badly by all his lies.
He did. You know? And so, everybody, ironic. I mean, that was a bipartisan consensus that gain of function research in terms of coronaviruses, especially whatever benefits what might accrue from them, was not worth the cost or the risk of the cost. It was too much of a gamble. That's why it was outlawed. And again, Anthony Fauci is sort of like, I mean, this whole thing is very similar, mutatis mutandis, with the necessary changes being made to the laptop and the information on the laptop, but more importantly, its relationship to these documents. And Everybody knows that our health bureaucratic establishment is trying to hide something, and was the whole time. And everybody knows there was a red line, an explosive point. And if at any point there is conclusive, demonstrable evidence that Anthony Fauci and his colleagues in the U.S. government routed money, and this is what Rand Paul got at, and he grilled him on this, and that money unambiguously helped create the SARS virus and gain of function viruses, and that led to this pandemic, then they're all through. They can say that they're retiring, they got great pensions, they're beloved, they've got bobble dolls or whatever they are. He's got a whole office with pictures of himself and press. He's done. And the same thing, as I said earlier, is true about the classified documents, or garage gate as it's been known. You find one item of demonstrable, unassailable proof that Hunter Biden looked at, examined, used, whatever, classified information which his father brought out unlawfully from a secure location as a senator, as a vice president, and kept as a private citizen. And the Biden family, that consortium, is all through. Yeah. Because nobody can, I say that because nobody can defend it. There will be people who will want to defend Fauci, and all they're going to have to say is, so then you think it was okay to fund research that led to the creation of the SARS virus? Is that what you're saying? Or people on the left, people will say to them, so you think it's okay that Hunter Biden, who with his record of recklessness was examining papers that had classification top secret warnings on them, and he at the same time was leveraging foreign governments for money because of the status of his father as the future president. Okay, that's what you want to defend? They won't defend that.
Yeah. Well, that'll be good.
We'll see. Well, I'm not trying to prejudge it. I don't know if that's true. No. I'm just throwing it out there because something has to. We know why Fauci is all over the place and worried and gets angry and screams and yells at people now and loses his temper, because he knows he's got culpability. We just don't know, have the exact proof in its fullness yet. But there's something weird about these documents. And the one question that the people are not asking is, what was the general nature of the documents? Why did Joe Biden take them out? Why were they moved around? Who was in charge to allow such sloppy storage? And were they used for any Biden purpose? And you put it all together and you get this image of somebody, you know, here's a document. I'm in the library today. It's in the dining room. It's in the garage. Oh, there's, go get me that one from the pen. When did we move it? That kind of attitude.
Yeah.
That's not good.
No, that sure isn't. And sure seems very sloppy on his part. So we'll see what happens. They may blame the archivist for letting the materials
well,
go.
Well, they're already bringing that poor woman. Was her name Chung?
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, she was known to Hunter Biden, and he recommended that she be the person that is in charge of Biden's affairs in the sense of storage and things like that. And they're already leaking out of the White House that she may be culpable. They've got to find somebody.
Yeah, exactly. They may have their fall guy. So, well, Victor, let's go ahead and take a break and come back and talk about the Minneapolis City Council and a vacancy tax they're contemplating, and then also students tyrannizing over faculty at institutions. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
We're back at the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Welcome, Victor. A very strange thing. Minneapolis's downtown was destroyed and the buildings are largely vacant and they're trying to figure out ways to make money. So they're thinking of taxing people for having vacant buildings. I was wondering
your
thoughts on that.
It's very funny. That's come up in San Francisco too, I think. So our listeners should have patience with me here because they're not going to believe it, but so you're in charge of the government of the city of Minneapolis, or to a lesser degree, maybe the state's influence, governor, and you defund a large part of the police budget, and you don't arrest, try, convict, incarcerate violent criminals. You have a soft spot or a blind spot for violent protests where people who loot, burn, and arson are not punished. You superimpose those short-term disasters on the longer-term catastrophes that Minneapolis is a blue city in the blue state of Minneapolis, of Minnesota, that's highly regulated, highly taxed. And you put it all together and people do not want to start businesses. They can't count on security. They can't count on homeless people not being in front of their stores. So they're not renting space. And the landlords don't have any income. So they're just letting the buildings stay vacant. Nobody wants to rent from them at any price. And so given that it's not viable, keep using that word viable today, they come and think you can legislate reality. Okay, we drove everybody out. We impoverished it. We ruined the downtown by our policies. Now we're going to make another law and says that if you react to all the things that we did to ruin you by not having a renter, we're going to force you to. We're going to tax you. We're going to punish you. I guess the only solution would be, they've destroyed my building. It has no market value. Now they're going to make me pay for the no market value. I'll just open it up and invite Antifa and BLM to open an office in it, or maybe make it a homeless shelter. And then at least I won't have to pay a fine for having it open. And I guess what would they say then? They would say, well, it's crowded, but it's viable.
Yeah.
It's busy.
It's crazy.
These people, I think a lot of it is that, to tell you the truth, it's very scary, because this is something that is, that goes back to classical literature, but it's in Tocqueville. It's in a lot of Hobbes. It's in Adam Smith. But when you have a large number of people who are not independent, autonomous, self-reliant, in other words, they get a check in the mail and they work for a bureaucracy or an organization or a large conglomerate or consortium, whatever term we use, then they lose touch with reality. So they just think they can legislate everything and tell people what to do because the check always comes in the mail for them. Mm-hmm. And so they don't understand that we're $31 trillion in debt. They don't worry about that. They work at the DMV. They work at the Equal Opportunity Office. They work at City Council. They work in the EPA, whatever it is. But they have that view. When you get the majority, the vast majority, because you can make an argument that in some ways two out of every three people are connected with government employment, then they lose all reality. They have no sense of reality. So they really do believe they can tax somebody who's losing money because of their policies and punish them because they don't put renters in that don't exist.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just crazy.
It's like, well, Gavin Newsom outlawing natural gas, heating in California, I guess, in 5 years, or saying you can't buy a truck in 5 years, or it's just nutty. I'm a bourbon king. I say we're going to do this, and this is going to be a fiat. And only a person who's never had to worry about his money coming from his long-haul trucking or his crop of Santa Rosa plums or his steel factory or his job not getting laid off as he, creates airbags in a factory. Only people who don't do all that would come up with these loony ideas. Yeah. Put them in the real world, and I think they would be quickly abused of these fantasies.
Well, Victor, we have a last topic today, and that is the creation of a student body that's been fed on critical race theory and has been nursing its diversity, equity, and inclusion grievances, and so indoctrinated that Christopher Rufo in City Journal writes this, and adults means the teachers and the administration, and members are the students he's referring to. And here's what he says. The adults have effectively ceded authority to the most aggressive, intolerant, and ideological members of the community who wield the language of, quote, trauma and, quote, diversity in pursuit of a suffocating left-wing orthodoxy, which they use to justify a perpetual campaign to silence and exclude anyone on the wrong political end of the intersectional hierarchy. He's right. The students are becoming very tyrannical in all of the schooling that they're getting from this left wing.
Well, they keep pushing this, and then you get a governor who's courageous and competent, and that's Ron DeSantis. So he puts on that College of Florida, I guess it's his regents. Did you see the names that he put on there? Charles Kessler, Mark Bauerlin, Matthew Spalding, Christopher Rufo that you just quoted. I mean, these are all some of the best and most accomplished conservative academics and intellectuals in the United States. So, I mean, they earned those people because those guys know what they're doing, and they're going to go in there and they're going to stop it. And it's just amazing that these universities think that they continue. There's no laws of physics, in other words. And you and I talk about this a lot, Sammy. And you know what? I want to interject here that I did read a lot of letters, and these were not just the regular comments on the podcast or electronic messaging to me, but they were written out. So when I go to my office each week, I've got a wonderful assistant, Andre, and he gives me mail, but I also, you know, when I'm there before it's passed on to him to examine and look at, I read it, I always read it, but my gosh, you should see the reaction. A lot of people wrote us and they said, how did you know that we don't trust Stanford degrees? Or how do you know we don't trust BAs in electrical engineering? Or how do you know, did you know that we offer test? And the topic and the theme was the same all over the country. It was, we don't trust universities anymore. And some of them were long letters, some were short, but here was what I'm getting at. Here was the common theme. The common theme, one guy really wrote and explained it. And also in this case, a guy wrote me an email, but it was this. Why wouldn't it not be this way? If you destroy meritocracy on the front end of admissions and you think you're going to re-engineer the world by letting people in without meeting your own criteria that you used to profess was absolutely necessary. I mean, nobody put a gun to Harvard and Yale and said you have to require an SAT test, right? Or a GPA. So they didn't do that. They did it. And they did it because they wanted supposedly the best students in the country. Okay, so if you destroy that, blow it up, atomize it, then what do you do when the students do not meet your former requirements? Then the process starts to kick in, Sammy. Then the courses are watered down. And the people who were admitted meritocratically, there's still some, they just goof off. They say, hey, I can take this introduction to computer science and I can, you know, I'll play Tetris while they're lecturing. This is a joke. And they're not challenged. And then the grading is watered down. The amount of work is watered down. And ultimately, the degree has to be watered down. It means nothing. And the employer is in a existential fight with India and China and Vietnam and Singapore and all these foreign countries that are developing tech centers and industries, and they want to keep ahead of them. And unfortunately for them, those universities that were way, way behind us are catching up in China, in India, because they don't do this. They used to do it with Mao. They used to have ideological constraints, but they allow people in the sciences, at least, to be free of communist indoctrination. And they can be, in a weird way, they can be more meritocratic than ours, that their indoctrination is suspended in matters of national import in the sciences, and ours isn't. So now all the things we've talked about this last year about the political correctness, the wokeness, the diversity, equity, that has now jumped over a hurdle, like the firewall, the last bastion, the rampart, which was always built around the STEM courses, the engineering, the science, the mathematics. And it's jumped over and it's in them now. And once it gets to them, that's the heart, that's the brain of the country. And then things don't work, and that's happening now. And so what he's writing about is you destroy meritocracy, and there's no reason why, when we have people coming from Venezuela, we have people coming from Colombia, we have people coming from India, we have people coming in droves from Mexico. Now, why are they coming? Is it because they love the Declaration of Independence? Is it because they love the memory of Abraham Lincoln? Is it because they love Barack Obama or Donald Trump? Is it because they're racist and they just love so-called 65.8% white people? Is that what it is? No, it's none of that. It's based on one point, that the United States, for a variety of reasons, was the most meritocratic, and they see that as a quality of opportunity, meaning that who your father was, what color of your skin is, how much money you have in the bank, how you speak a particular, that doesn't matter. You can make it if you work hard and you're meritocratic, and then things start to work. There's not trash by the sides of the road. The sewage doesn't overflow into the streets when it rains. People in the hospital don't try to reuse a disposable needle There's rules, there's regulations. It makes life good, and they want a part of it. But you destroy meritocracy, and you become just like them. I was thinking the other day that I thought, well, maybe Biden is so worried that he might not get elected because he destroyed the border that he wants to, when Mayorkas and he say the border is going to be secure, maybe they think they're going to so destroy meritocracy that nobody would want to come here. You know what I mean? So it's like, if you were in Oaxaca, you said, why should I go up there? The medicine's just as good here. The water makes you sick up there just as much as it does here. You know, there's people living out in rural California with porta potties just like here. So what's the purpose? And I think that's really a scary thought when you destroy meritocracy. Yeah. And remember what meritocracy was. It was the enemy of tribalism. It always was. It was the priest. It was the ancient divide between pre-civilizational life and civilizational life. The moment you were not allowed to use your superficial appearance or your shared DNA for your advantage of your group, but you had to be meritocratic. You had to pick the best person to serve on a water board or to be a general. Then suddenly things started happening, good things. But we're hell-bent and going backward through history, back to our pre-civilizational tribal pedigree. It's really scary how these so-called liberal utopians want to make us pre-civilizational, pre-cultural. And the best way to do it is to destroy meritocracy and just pick people on their tribal affiliations and then go through the motions as if it's still a university. Just because it says Stanford or Yale or Princeton when you drive up to it, or it has its logo or its particular color or its stamp, or it doesn't mean anything. All that means anything is the quality of education that its students receive and the competency and the excellence that they exhibit as they leave that university and for the rest of their life. You destroy that, you have nothing. There's nothing left. It just becomes a joke. And that's what they're doing. But they're not just doing it haphazardly. They're doing it systematically at rapid speed, almost as like lemmings going over the cliff. And you know what's sad about it? When you look at the people, and I'm not going to mention names because I know the people at Stanford that are doing it. But when you look at them, it was all, they destroyed the university for a very cheap price. It was 3 more years as a dean, 4 more years as a president, 5 more years as a provost. That was, in other words, they would say or do anything or cave or appease just so they could enjoy their perks for a little bit longer. But it was Samson-like. They just pulled the house on top of them. Yeah. And I don't see how they're going to get out of it. I don't. It would be, think about, Sammy, as we leave and we'll stop. What would it entail to stop the woke stuff in the university? How could you do it? That's like saying, how could you be in Russia in 1965 and say we're going to get rid of the commissars and the military, or 1943? How would you do it? Well, we're going to get rid of the nomenclatura. I don't know how you do it. I don't.
Well, now that you're saying it that way, you will need an election to bring in a whole new leadership, and then they can start. I know that what you're trying to suggest is it's so embedded in those universities that even if you have a Republican president and Congress, it's not going to change anything at the level of the university.
Well, that's a famous phrase in Latin, you know, attributed, I think, to Sallust, the medicine is, and Livy talked about it, both of them, I think. You can't do anything when the medicine is deemed worse than the disease. So what this moderate little effort that DeSantis is trying to do, they're going hysterical about it. That is just like a tiptoe of what needs to be done. Yeah. I mean, you need to go in there and reestablish objective criteria for retention, promotion, and tenure. And you need to have an admissions policy that's absolutely meritocratic. And that means legacies as well as diversity, equity, inclusion. And then you need to have absolute free speech and inquiry, and you have to have complete due process and the Bill of Rights about every issue that comes up about, you know, legality on campus. And you really have to do that. And you have to take that. You'd have to take the entire curriculum, anything with a dash studies, get rid of it. Yeah. You know, Black studies, gay studies, environmental studies. The university was wonderful where there was no studies. The studies was incorporated in philosophy and history and biology and math. They didn't need these little subgroups. Their subgroups were each week's syllabus. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And exactly. So it would be a monumental task. And the person who would do it, I mean, when Larry Summers was kind of sloppy in the way he did it, but he just timidly suggested that maybe there were cultural factors that promoted more male mathematicians than female, or for various reasons. And then to save his job, he gave the women's studies, what, $50 million? And it still wasn't enough. And they destroyed him. After that, he was destroyed. I mean, in every aspect of his professional life. And so it's hard to know who wants to. I mean, there were people that were presidents that, I don't know, unless you took Hillsdale College. And some billionaire that's listening, you said to yourself, I want a legacy that saved America. Here's $5 billion. And you go to President Larry Arnn and say, please, please, I want $1 billion for a campus in California. I want $1 billion for a start in, you know, Mississippi. I want $1 billion in Washington, D.C. I want $1 billion in Minneapolis, and just Xerox Hillsdale. And maybe that would work. But
yeah. That's a dream, though, Victor. That's a lot of money.
I would say, you know, if you're going to give money, again, don't be flattered by these universities. Don't say, you know, and the cost of getting your child in, if that's how you look at an education, if you're very wealthy, has really gone up because there's not that many room. When you have a diversity, equity, inclusion, huge repertory percentage, then they're charging you with a wink and a nod a lot more money to get your child into a university that's a lot more mediocre than it was. Yeah. So if you really think that your own BA from Harvard or Princeton or Duke or wherever is, you want to enhance it by giving money, I wouldn't do it. It's over with. And if you were going to give money, I would have such strict restrictions on it, if it was all possible, how it could be spent. And even then, they would avoid and circumvent your instructions. You'd be much better off to give it to St. Thomas Aquinas or Hillsdale College.
Yeah. All right. Victor, well, we are at the end of our time. Thank you so much for everything today. It was a wonderful discussion. I enjoyed it myself. I'm sure your listeners did. And thanks to the listeners as well.
We got through it. We had some barking dogs and a couple of electronic problems, but we got through it. And everybody, thank you. We really appreciate you listening.
Yeah.
And I try to read everything that comes in one way or the other, whether on the website or Andre gives me the letters or I look at them myself or I look at my email. They're very helpful.
Yeah, they are all very helpful. Thank you so much. And all the comments on the articles, too.
They
we
are.
Really appreciate
I
that.
Really
at the
appreciate
website.
It. There's a lot more of us out there, you guys, and we think that we're in the minority. I think we're in the majority. I really do. And
yeah.
I think they're going to. I misspoke before the midterm election when I was optimistic that I didn't think the Republicans would blow it like they did in the Senate. But I'm getting optimistic again that we're the majority.
All right. Well, thank you, Victor.
Okay, thank you, everybody.
All right, this is Sammy Wink and Victor Davis Hanson, and we're signing off.